What should you really do about sunscreen?
Do steroid injections help in people that have spinal stenosis?
What about bone marrow transplantation for adults with sickle cell disease?
And genetic and environmental factors that contribute to the development of celiac disease in kids.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on July 4th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech Health Science Center El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Wow. Did you hear all that, you guys? Everybody who's listening, we all have to refer to him now as El Presidente. So congratulations, Rick, but I'm going to keep calling you Rick.
Well, I'm pleased, Elizabeth, that despite my move to El Paso, we're still going on with the podcast. And happy birthday, United States. It's July 4th.
Exactly right. So hope those fireworks are fabulous in El Paso. Since it's July 4th, then let's turn right away to the recommendations by MDs. What do physicians recommend with regard to the use of sunscreen? That's in JAMA Dermatology.
Elizabeth, how many people are annually affected with skin cancer in the United States?
It's in the millions, I think.
Absolutely right. It's 2 million individuals. Unfortunately, when you go to see your primary care physician, there's so many things that he or she has to do. They've got to manage your chronic disease. They do counseling regarding tobacco, diet, alcohol, safe sex practices, exercise, update immunizations, manage Medicaid, all these things. And in all of that, you might ask, how often do physicians actually discuss the use of sunscreen? That's what this study attempted to address. This is a study that took place over about 20 years, from 1989 to 2010. So of over 18.3 billion patient visits, let me repeat that, 18.3 billion patient visits, physicians mentioned sunscreen in approximately 12.8 million. That is 0.07%. That's not very good.
That's startling in how low it is. I can't even, it's hard for me to believe.
And the group that was most likely to do it was obviously dermatologists. 86% of them were dermatologists. But when you went back and said of 100 dermatologists, how many of them actually documented speaking to their patients about the use of sunscreen? It was just 1.6%. So this tells us that discussion of sunscreen use is very low.
Wow, that really is rather sobering, isn't it? And of course, you may recall, I'm sure you do, the study that we talked about that looked at those folks in Australia and the daily application of sunscreen and how it significantly reduced the signs of photo aging in that population. So I guess my hope is that people are getting that message from public kinds of sources. It sure would be nice if we had that underpinned by interactions with the medical system.
You're right. And obviously, we're now one of those public sources of information. The thing that was particularly revealing about this study is you would think that they would direct it toward people that are younger. But most of the individuals in whom this issue was discussed were actually in their eighth decade of life. So we need to do a much better job of getting the information out, particularly to our younger patients.
And I'll reveal that now that we've discussed that issue about photo aging, I indeed am using sunscreen on a daily basis. So from here then, why don't we turn to this rather provocative issue of bone marrow transplantation in folks with sickle cell disease. That's in the journal of the American Medical Association.
Although sickle cell only affects about 100,000 Americans, most of those being African American, and 300,000 individuals worldwide, it is a devastating disease. And in this condition, the hemoglobin protein is abnormal, and it causes the red blood cells, which carry the oxygen, to actually form a sickle shape. And in that shape, they can occlude blood vessels, which can affect the kidneys, can cause strokes, cause severe bone disease and pain as well. And despite the fact we've identified the cause of it, we've not had very good therapy. Hence the use of bone marrow transplant to affect that, taking a recipient that has sickle cell, giving them appropriate bone marrow stem cells of related individuals that can populate their bone marrow with normal red blood cells or the precursor of normal red blood cells. What's unique about this particular study is usually when a bone marrow transplant is done, they have to do what's called myeloablative therapy. They give you either some type of chemotherapy combined with radiation therapy to destroy as much of your bone marrow as possible and then give you the transplant. That's obviously associated with a number of complications. In this particular study, they took 30 individuals, 16 to 65 years of age, that had severe sickle cell disease and used a non-myoablative technique. They gave them a small dose of radiation, bone marrow transplant from a sibling that was almost identical in terms of their proteins. And of the 30 patients, 29 survived for a median of about 3.5 years. There was only one patient who died. That was due to the fact they had a stroke about 7 months after they received the bone marrow transplant. The grafts took in about 87% of the individuals. It significantly decreased the symptoms, hospitalizations, the use of narcotics as well, and there are no serious side effects.
So this is excellent news, of course, because for those of us who are blissfully unaffected by sickle cell disease, I'm not sure we can really appreciate the fact that it's excruciatingly painful for people when they have an episode.
Elizabeth, you couldn't have described it better. It is excruciating how they describe the pain. On average, they're in the hospital about 2 to 3 times per year with severe sickle cell crisis. And during most of the time, they're on some type of chronic narcotic. The pain is so devastating. So the question is, how can we expand that to people that are less genetically similar but still obtain equally good results?
And my last public health message on this particular issue is that we know that African Americans often are reluctant to come forward and register for national registries so that they can be marrow donors. And so I guess I would encourage folks to step forward and do that, because this really is a life-saving or a life-altering kind of a treatment. From here, let's turn to something that affects many, 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 many people. That spinal stenosis, when that little canal, doesn't work too well in the spine, it impinges on the nerves. People have a lot of pain in their lower backs, very common condition. And of course, the injection of steroids into that area has received lots of attention because of the fungal infections people have gotten recently. But when we look at it critically, that's in the New England Journal of Medicine, doesn't seem like it really works.
And I didn't realize the magnitude of the problem. There are 10 to 11 million epidural injections annually in the United States alone. Most of those epidural injections are for what you described, that is spinal stenosis. It causes impingement on the nerve root that causes severe leg pain and disability. And this is often tried before surgery. But the real question is it very effective? This was a double-blind study conducted at many different sites where they randomly assigned 400 patients who had lumbar central spine stenosis and moderate to severe leg pain, and they randomized them to receive injections of just lidocaine, a local anesthetic, or lidocaine with steroids. Now, the lidocaine only lasts for a short period of time, for about an hour or two. And the outcome was, at the end of 6 weeks, they administered a questionnaire and also assessed the intensity of leg pain. And what they found was, in those individuals who received lidocaine alone versus those who received lidocaine with steroids, there was no significant difference at all. Although the study wasn't large enough or powered enough to look at different types of injection, whether it was interlaminar or transforaminal for our physicians, there appeared to be no difference between the type of injection either.
And I applaud these folks for doing this, because I think that this is an assessment we've needed for quite some time. I know that people who are experiencing acute episodes of back pain are really desperate for some kind of relief. But I think that now that we've seen some of the dangers that can be inherent in that strategy, looking at this critically, I applaud these folks for doing that.
We've talked about this before. There's a feeling like if there's something wrong, if you don't do something about it, that you're not giving proper therapy. Sometimes the best therapy is just a little bit of time, and sometimes rehabilitation and physical therapy. This is one of those circumstances. So, Elizabeth, I think it was a great study to highlight this week.
All right. And on that note, I guess I'll even pick that one for the blog. Finally, then, let's turn to this issue again in the New England Journal of Medicine, and something else that I applaud these folks for doing, a look at celiac disease in kids. Gosh, that's the latest darling of the disease world, isn't it? And what's happening in their genes?
I picked this particular study. It is a little bit of a nerdy study. Here's why I found it particularly interesting. As you know, celiac disease is an autoimmune disease, just like type 1 diabetes. And there's an ongoing study called the TEDDY trial. It looks at the environmental determinants of diabetes in the young. Because they're looking at what are called genetic haplotypes, the different types of genes inherited from each of the patients and how they can interact to cause type 1 diabetes, we can extend that same information to celiac disease as well. And that's what they did in this particular study. They have over 6,400 kids in which they can determine the haplotype. These were kids in both Europe and the United States. And in those with the particular haplotype called DR3/DQ2, which is associated with celiac disease, if they had this particular haplotype at the end of 5 years, the risk of having celiac disease with just one of those gene abnormalities was about 12%, with both genes being involved was 26%. But the interesting thing was that if you were in Sweden, you had twice the likelihood of developing a celiac disease with that same haplotype change as you were in the United States. So what that tells us is that there's not only a genetic predisposition, but there must be some environmental factors that affect the development as well.
Something, of course, that we've talked about a million times, and that is that the genes may set you up for something, but you need another bunch of factors in order to really manifest.
Now what we need to do is figure out what those environmental factors are.
On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm President Lang. Y'all live well.